From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, we look at the Trump administration's new immigration rules in our week in review. Here's President Trump today at the Conservative Political Action Conference.
As we speak today, immigration officers are finding the gang members, the drug dealers, and the criminal aliens and throwing them the hell out of our country.
Also today, local author Andrew Krivak's new novel, The Signal Flame.
What they shared were the wars of emperors, presidents, revolutionaries, fights to which men have always gone to fight, for an ideal, for a homeland, for a people.
And the untold story of how a four-year-old girl took on school segregation here in Boston, 100 years before Brown versus Board of Education. All that coming up on Radio Boston. First, the news.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Friday, which means it's time for our week in review, starting with President Trump's new moves on immigration. The Department of Homeland Security issued rules this week increasing border security and tightening enforcement of immigration laws. Here's President Trump speaking yesterday, saying that his immigration guidelines mean dangerous immigrants here illegally will finally be deported.
All of a sudden, for the first time, we're getting gang members out, we're getting drug lords out, we're getting really bad dudes out of this country, and at a rate that nobody's ever seen before. And they're the bad ones.
But on Tuesday, Massachusetts Senator Ed Markey explained why he disagrees with the administration's move.
My fear is that this could lead to families across our country fearing that there would be a Gestapo-like knock on their door, not just along the Mexican border, but all across the country.
Joining us now in studio to talk about this and the rest of the week's big news is Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe and a WBUR contributor. Renee, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tanya.
Also with us is Richard Tse, former Republican state senator. Richard, welcome back to the show.
Happy to be here.
So President Trump has directed his administration to enforce the nation's immigration rules more aggressively. What's your reaction to this move, Renee?
You know, I think it's problematic. You know, as much as the Trump administration wants to say this will not lead to mass deportations, there's really no reason to believe that, especially with what's been happening so far. You know, the emphasis has been on, you know, we're going to get out, as he calls them, quote unquote, bad dudes. But what this is really doing is criminalizing people whose only offense was wanting to come to this country for a better life. You know, there are people who will not have criminal records who are going to be scooped up. And so I think there's a problem with how this is being enacted.
Richard, what's your take?
Well, I don't think it's a surprise. You know, when President Trump ran for office, this was one of his cornerstones in his campaign. He was very clear as to what he wanted to do. And they've been very careful. Pretty much everybody in the administration has said that this isn't about mass deportations. This is a group of people that are in the country that have committed crimes in the country. If Ed Markey wants to defend, you know, gang members, drug dealers, you know, people who have committed crimes, he should go right ahead and do that. But I think, you know, 80% of the public wants to see those people deported. And we have so many checks and balances in this country. If it does turn out that they're, you know, it turns into something, you know, that's inappropriate, I think it's going to, you know, well, it's not going to be very hard to stop.
Well, we had checks and balances. I'm not sure what we have now. If you look at what happened with the initial immigration order and what mass chaos that caused, then I don't really see that as any checks and balances that somehow make sure that, quote unquote, the bad people are the only ones who get deported.
On that vein, I'd love to ask you both about what happened just in the executive order on immigration and refugees last month and how this plays into what's happening now. There was a lot of pushback on that, and there were a lot of troubles legally on that executive order. Do you feel like this one fixes those challenges in any way?
You know, I think you have to have a little perspective. You know, we allow over 1 million people into the country legally every year. No other country, Aaron, comes close to the United States. So, you know, even though we're so generous and welcoming as a country, you have this huge problem that has been lingering for decades right now where, you know, people don't want to follow an orderly process and come into the country. And I do think, you know, we're not going to exist as a country very long without borders and without some type of, you know, immigration process that is fair to the people who have waited for years to be able to come in. And I think that's what Trump is, you know, trying to deal with, and it isn't going to be perfect. You know, every administration, especially when they first come in, makes mistakes. That was sloppy, his first order, regarding the refugees. But I think that, you know, he's bringing some order to the program in general.
Well, you know, I think I'd feel differently about what he's doing if there was any sign that this was going to affect undocumented immigrants from Ireland or from Poland or from Italy. What this is an attack on Mexican immigrants, and what it feels like to me is this effort to enact this kind of de-browning of America. You know, this is about Mexican immigrants. I'm not seeing this about all immigrants, and surely there have to be people from other countries who are here without the documents to be here. So let's just see how this plays out, but I have no reason to feel optimistic about any way that this administration is going to handle this immigration issue.
Richard, what do you say to that, that it affects brown people in this country, essentially?
You know what? I think that overall, most Americans understand that we need to have borders in the country. We just can't have open borders. People just can't walk into the country. And if people aren't coming
in. But this idea
in,
specifically see, that it doesn't affect those maybe from Ireland or for some other places.
We should be able to control who comes into the country. And, you know, and if more people should be coming in from Central America and Mexico, then the law should be changed to allow those people to come in legally. You know, you can't come in if you're Italian, or you can't come in if you're Irish, because, you know, each country is apportioned a certain number of people who can come into the country every year. The United States has the ability to do that. So if we're not bringing in enough people, you know, but the fact is, you know, we're a nation of laws, and you just can't, you know, we haven't been following the law for a long time, and it's had a lot of consequences in the country. So
let's hear from White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer at the White House press briefing on Tuesday. He said that the president's new executive order on immigration is basically going to allow immigration officials to do their jobs.
For so long, the people at ICE and CBP had their hands cuffed behind them, and when they were going to deal with the mission of their job. The last administration had so many carve-outs for who could be and who couldn't be adjudicated that it made it very difficult for the customs and enforcement people to do their job and enforce the laws of this country.
Okay, so to add to this idea, part of this new policy expands a program that lets officials bypass due process protections, such as court hearings, and includes expedited removal for immigrants who have been arrested and in the country for up to 2 years. There have been arguments in the past that this backlog of immigration court cases is part of the problem in enforcing immigration law. So with all of that in mind, is Spicer right? Do you feel like these new orders are going to make it easier for quote-unquote immigration officials to do their jobs? I'll let you start, Richard, and then I'll hear from you, Renee.
Well, I think for years, people of both Democrats and Republicans have turned a blind eye to the fact that there are 11 million people in the country who are here illegally. And clearly, we're not going to deport 11 million people. But I do think that the president has a lot of support when he's talking about, you know, deporting gang members, people who have been convicted of crimes. I know that there are prisons in Southern California that, 80% of the people who are in the prison are illegal immigrants. And you know, and they're committing crimes here. And I'm not saying everybody is, but for those people who are that are a problem, they should be sent out of the country. And I can't, you know, if we're debating that, we're in a lot of trouble as a country, because we are going to be a country without borders, and we're not going to be a country for much longer.
Renee,
first I'm a little curious where that 80% figure came from of prisons in California filled with illegal immigrants.
I'll get that to you,
please,
actually.
Please, yeah. Thank you. From
the fake media. I read it somewhere, actually.
I can imagine. Yeah. Okay, I can imagine where you got that from. Look, here's the thing. You know, we are a nation of laws, and when you start talking about suspending due process, it starts to sound like we're leading towards another mass incarceration situation. You know, they've been said, well, we're going to get more immigration judges. Really, where are those going to come from? Where are you going to get the ICE officers to enact all this? You know, it all sounds good on paper, but as we've seen with this administration, it seems very difficult to pull these things off within the bounds of the law and in a way that's respectful of families and communities. You know, yes, there are people here who are undocumented, but they are an important part of this economy and they're an important part of the communities where they live. And so this idea that, again, you're going to just criminalize 11 million people. Are there bad people in there? Probably. I don't doubt that there are. But I also think that the majority of them are not criminals. And they're all being treated as criminals.
No, but I think everybody, again, General Kelly has been very specific. There aren't going to be mass deportations. I mean, they're looking at a very specific group of people. And I
don't know that I have
and you're talking about suspending,
to trust this administration
saying,
and what it says at this
but
point.
But you're saying, you know, suspending due process. If you're here illegally, you're not a citizen of the country. You don't have due process. I mean, if you've,
then why not just have mass deportations then?
Well, to that point, I'd love to hear. I want both of you guys to hear from Carol Rose. She's the executive director of the ACLU of Massachusetts, and she spoke to us on Wednesday and said that Trump's immigration order means that Immigration and Customs Enforcement will no longer have clear priorities.
It's sort of like saying open season on anyone who may have overstayed their visa. Open season on people who look like they might be from a different country, and mostly that's going to be people who are brown and black skinned. Open season on pulling people over and hassling them.
So that's kind of to your point, Renee. Well, it's exactly to your point. Do you agree with Carol Rose here that the effect of this agreement will declare open season on immigrants? And I know, Richard, you've said that no one is actually for those who are committing crimes to continue to proliferate in the country.
No, apparently, but apparently there are a lot of people who don't want those people removed from the country, and that's the problem.
I think the idea is that
who doesn't want criminals removed?
Ed Markey, for instance. I mean, you just quoted him at the beginning of this segment saying that it's a bad idea to go after those people because it could lead to other things.
No, what he's saying is that it could lead to other things by having these types of rules in place that you have people who actually are law-abiding citizens and people who may not be a part of this population swept up along with this.
But given the current politics and state of the country right now, I think if they start a roundup and they start taking people who haven't committed crimes, you know, and deporting them, it's just not going to happen. You know,
I admire your confidence.
Well, you're not going to let it happen, Renee, and other people aren't going to let it happen. So, I mean, we're talking about a very small group of people, and we got to decide: are we a country where, you know, we have to fix this? We need an Immigration Reform Act, and I think Donald Trump, believe it or not, is the only person who could probably do it. It's sort of like Nixon going to China. He can hopefully sit down with the Democrats and make a deal that will solve this problem in a long time. And he's probably the only Republican who could ever do it. But we're going to have to decide, are we a country where the rule of law takes precedence? And if the laws aren't right, let's fix them and secure the country.
Well, if it didn't seem like it was the whole idea was to round up Mexican immigrants and push them back over the border, I might feel differently about this. But there's no indication that that's going to happen.
Let's talk a little bit about what's happening here locally. So Plymouth and Bristol County sheriffs have announced they're joining forces with ICE, allowing the county jails to screen inmates for deportation. Should we expect to see more of these partnerships or perhaps more pushback against them? What's your sense? What's your feeling, Renee?
I think you might have both. I mean, I think there will certainly be sheriffs who will want to comply and say, okay, we're going to go along with the president's order. And there will be other municipalities that say, we're absolutely positively not doing this. That is not our job. And not even the point of being sanctuary cities, but just it is not the job of our local police department to be immigration officers. You know, and anything that I think also that could lead to more profiling and, you know, the more targeting of certain communities.
I just think that the rule of law is the principle that should govern the country, and arbitrary decisions by individual office holders shouldn't determine, you know, on a case-by-case basis what the law should be. And if once we lose the rule of law in the country, I mean, you know, and sheriffs are deciding, well, our sanctuary, you know, governors or mayors are deciding, well, I'm not going to pay attention to this law. I'm going to pay attention to this one. We're not going to be a country.
Well, how come it can't just be states' rights? You know how much the Trump administration loves to use that term. How come it can't be left up to the states to decide?
I love it when liberals start talking about states' rights.
Speaking of that, yes, and we're going to be talking about it.
I hate it when conservatives start talking about states' rights. So.
Speaking of states' rights, let's go to our next topic. Also this week, the Trump administration rolled back a rule that was put in place last year, which allows students to use bathrooms that correspond with their gender identity. Here's White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer speaking yesterday about this.
I've made this clear, and the president's made it clear throughout the campaign, that he's a firm believer in states' rights and that certain issues like this are not best dealt with at the federal level.
Well, Massachusetts passed a law last year expanding protections for transgender men and women in public accommodations, including public bathrooms and locker rooms. State leaders like Attorney General Maura Healey are speaking out against the action.
This isn't about states' rights or presidential power. This is about the targeting of an already vulnerable population, our transgender students and young people across this country.
Richard, what's your reaction?
I think President Trump made a mistake, and this is where I would say the federal government has an important role to play in that it should be there to protect people. I originally was one of the co-sponsors of the original transgender protection bill here in Massachusetts. The state has done a great job. Obviously, this executive order isn't going to affect us here in the state. And to President Trump, I would say, you know, it's the economy, stupid. We shouldn't be involved, you know, in social issues right now. Everything should be about getting the economy going again. That's his strength. And I think when you veer off into a subject matter like this, where there's a lot of division here and within the Republican Party, he's making him, and among a lot of Americans, he's making a mistake.
Renee?
I agree with Richard. I think what the Trump administration did this week was mean-spirited and pointless. Why are you going after kids who are already part of such a vulnerable population? It achieves nothing. You know, the only thing it does achieve is, you know, this is the warning shot from Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who has a long history of hostility towards the LGBT community. You know, so this is him sort of throwing it down and letting people know, you know, we're coming after you. You know, nothing you have is safe. We don't care what happened with the Obama administration. We don't care about what you have. We're going to go after you. It does matter that in Massachusetts, students will be protected. But what happens in other states, you know?
You speak to this, Renee, talking about Sessions, but I'd love to know, Richard, from your point of view. So throughout the campaign, Trump really said that he would uphold protections for LGBT community members. Mm-hmm. And this is sort of an about face in that. What do you think is behind all of this?
Well, I guess it all depends how you look at it. I mean, since he has been in office, one of the first things he announced was that he was going to continue President Obama's non-discrimination workplace executive order, which prevents discrimination in the workforce for federal employees and also requires all subcontractors with the federal government, prevents them from discriminating or they're not doing business with the federal government. I think that that was a very good move by him. Obviously, this is more disappointing. And it's funny because he's using the same argument Renee just used for immigration, that states should have their own rights,
right,
and be able to decide this policy on both the state and the federal level. And I'd point out that the executive order, even though I don't agree with it, specifically says that state and local governments do have a responsibility to prevent, to protect those students who are, in school from bullying and protect their safety.
But,
now,
right.
I don't think that they should have done the order, but I'm just saying he's using a state's rights argument, which I think that when it comes to civil rights, the federal government has a role to play, and that role should be to ensure that every American is treated fairly and decently under the law.
So, what do you think this message sends to the transgender kids and kids who go to school with these students?
I think it says to the kids who are transgender that your government does not have your back. That, you know, there was a survey that came out this week from the Journal of American Medical Association that said prior to same-sex marriage being legalized nationally, that in states that had it, suicide rates among gay teens dropped 25%. What does that say now when you have rights that are taken away? What does that say about the value of your life and the way your government regards you?
And what I would just say was when you govern by the stroke of a pen, and what President Obama did here was just issue an executive order and signed it, another president can come in and undo it just as easily. And the reason we have marriage equality right now throughout the country is because there was a lot of education that took place in states and communities all around this country. And I think by the president signing the executive order, none of that infrastructure was built underneath, and it was easier to, I know that the Supreme Court's going to look at this, and I'm thinking that they probably will decide it in favor of transgendered rights.
Yes, students. So let's talk about our next topic, criminal justice. So while Massachusetts has the second lowest per capita incarceration rate in the nation, more than half of the people leaving jails and prisons end up returning at some point. That's according to a long-awaited criminal justice reform report released this week by state leaders. The report gives recommendations aiming at reducing recidivism in the Commonwealth. Here's Governor Charlie Baker speaking about the new push for criminal justice reform in Massachusetts.
Prison is, as it should be, a punishment, but the people of Massachusetts are better served when more individuals exit the system as law-abiding and productive members of society.
Richard, what's your reaction to this?
I was at a talk that the Chief Justice gave, and he's one of the people who are really a strong proponent of sentencing reform here in Massachusetts. And he made a really good case that our laws and our system really need to be modernized. And we do have the second lowest rate of incarceration in the country, but almost over 50% either come back to a house of correction or to prison. And, so there has to be a lot more done to keep people out of the system when they leave, and then in here to prevent them in the first place from going in.
Renee?
I think it's important, obviously, to make sure that jail isn't, a revolving door for lots of people. But what this doesn't address is ways to keep people out of the system to begin with. Mm-hmm. If you keep them out of the system, you don't have to worry about them coming back, and reoffending. So, to me, it's a great first step, but it's got a long way to go to really address the issue.
So along that line, Rashawn Hall, he's the director of the Racial Justice Program for the ACLU here in Massachusetts, criticized the report, just as you said, for focusing too much on the back end of the criminal justice system.
There is a lot missing on the front end. There's no conversation or meaningful analysis of diversion programs or bail reform or sentencing reform or prison conditions.
So, this report was very long in the making, so it's been a long time coming. And you spoke to this, but do you think it goes far enough in advocating for criminal justice reforms in the Commonwealth? What would you like to see more of, Renee?
Well, again, I'd like to see more done on the front end. What do you do with nonviolent offenders? Are there diversion programs? Are there things that could be looked at that keeps people out of the system? I think it's good that the state has such a low incarceration rate, but it's probably too high anyway on top of that, because you have a lot of people who are in the system who probably shouldn't be there because there aren't programs to ensure that nonviolent offenders don't end up in the system. And in a lot of cases, once they're in the system, it becomes harder and harder for them to get out. And once you're in the system, it also becomes harder and harder for you to get on with your life once you get out. So, it's the old expression, was it an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure? Mm-hmm. So, keep people out of the system. They'll deal with that part, and then I think the rest of it can take care of itself more easily.
Mm-hmm. Richard?
And I was going to say, I don't think that the report addressed mandatory minimum sentencing for nonviolent drug offenders. And that was something that the legislature did in the early 90s, and it was a bipartisan pretty much thing. I voted for them because it seemed like the right thing to do at the time, and clearly it's been a mistake, those need to be repealed at this point, because I think it had a lot of unintended consequences, and whoever you talk to in the criminal justice system will pretty much say that it's time for that to happen. And ultimately, this is going to go to the legislature, and regardless of what is in or not in the report right now, the legislature will have the final say, and I think you're going to see a bill passed that's more comprehensive than this report.
There's also this bill under consideration by the state Senate that would raise the age of offenders sent to juvenile court from 18 to 21. Advocates say that this they cite scientific research that shows that a person's brain is not fully developed until they're older, like 19 or 20 years old. And Massachusetts would be the first in the state to raise the age. What do you all think of this proposal?
Well, you know, everything that goes around, it's all, you know, we've dealt with
this
issue.
What goes around comes around, yeah.
No, we've dealt with this issue before. In the early 90s, I was on a conference committee that changed the law because we wanted to make sure we changed it to the current age of 18 because we wanted it, because there were instances of kids committing murder going into the juvenile system and being released within a short period of time and going back out on the streets and murdering again. And that's why the legislature in the early 90s changed the law and made it tougher for kids.
For,
you know, I think we set the, I think it was 18, I might be
18.
Wrong, at that point. So now here we are 30 years later looking at this again, and, you know, maybe the science has changed. I'd be a little more leery. You know, the minimum mandatory sentencing, definitely get rid of, but I'm not so sure about this.
Renee?
You know, I'm a little on the fence about it myself. I mean, I do understand, you know, some decisions have been made in criminal justice, such as, you know, you can't sentence someone to life without parole if they've committed, they're a juvenile offender. You know, it makes sense. You know, this whole idea of sort of throwing away the baby with the bathwater in a lot of cases. So I can see the logic behind this. You know, there's been a lot of studies that have talked about, you know, the developing teenage brain and what that means. And, you know, can you really evaluate what someone does at 16 for who they're going to be for the rest of their life? So, yeah, I think it's an important thing to look at. It's another piece of the puzzle in trying to figure out the issue with criminal reform.
Okay, so let's go to some lighter topics. Instead of ending our weekend review, right? Instead of ending our weekend review with hubbubs this week, we're going to give you picks ahead of Oscar weekend. It is Oscar weekend for Best Picture, Best Actor, and Best Actress. Renee.
Best Picture, for me, has to be Moonlight. It's Best Picture I've seen this year. It's the best picture I might have seen the last 5 years. It's
really
just extraordinary. Best Actor, I'm going to go with Denzel Washington.
Yeah.
Only because sometimes he really mails it in, and I really felt like this was a performance. Like, he really was completely invested in playing this character, which he's played on Broadway in Fences. And for actress, I was really torn again, but I went with Ruth Negga for Loving.
For Loving.
Yes.
Yes. Richard.
This was tougher than the subject matter. That
right, right. You had to
Not
do a little research, right?
Okay, so this is, I would go with the local, Manchester by the Sea. Obviously, a sad movie, but really, I think, talks about real struggles that families face. For Best Actress, Emma Stone, La La Land. They don't make, you know, musicals like that. She's super talented. She sang, danced, very good. And Andrew Garfield for Hacksaw Ridge. Must have been hard to be an actor to play that role, and he did a great job.
Interesting, interesting.
Didn't see that coming. Wow.
Right,
there
I know, I
go.
Didn't hear it. No one's been talking about
you
that.
Know?
I mean,
yeah.
Well, I mean, no one among my group. So okay, so Best Picture, Lion, yes. Best Actor, I'm with you, Renee. Denzel Washington, really, he embodied the character through and through. And this one, there was a lot of argument in the newsroom, but Meryl Streep as Florence Foster Jenkins. I think it's a fascinating story.
How many Oscars does she need?
See, you can't think of that. You have to have it stand alone for who she is in this role. And I thought she played it very well. Well, Renee Graham, columnist for the Boston Globe and a WBUR contributor. Renee, thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Tanya.
And Richard, former Republican state senator. Richard, thank you so much as well. You guys enjoy the weather and the weekend.
Thank you.
All right, well, stay with us. There is more ahead. I'm Tanya Mosley, and this is Radio Boston. The critically acclaimed book, The Sojourn, by Somerville author Andrew Krivak, follows the story of a young Slovakian immigrant to the U.S. who returns to Europe. only to find himself fighting in World War II. And now Somerville author Andrew Krivak continues that exploration of families, the legacy of war and redemption, in his second novel, The Signal Flame. He sat down with WBUR's Deborah Becker to talk about the book. It picks up where The Sojourn left off in a small town in northeastern Pennsylvania in 1972, and the family of Joseph Venish.
How did this book, The Signal Flame, follow The Sojourn?
The Signal Flame is entirely fiction. The Sojourn was an amalgam of stories that I had heard from my grandmother. My grandfather had passed away before I was born, about life in the old country, coming to America. Once I finished The Sojourn, I knew that there was I had a desire to write a story about what happened to Joseph Vinich. And so I...
Joseph Vinich is the grandfather.
He's the grandfather in the Sojourn. So what I wanted to do for The Signal Flame is to come right back to 1972. But I realized that I was finished with Joseph Vinich as a character speaking, and Darden, Pennsylvania, and the legacy that Joseph Vinich built after he came to Darden was really what the book was about, and particularly about this older grandson, Bohemir, or Bo Connor. Mm-hmm. The backdrop of war is still there in the shape of Vietnam in 1972 with the younger grandson missing in action.
Can you read the prologue?
Sure.
The Signal Flame? It sort of sets the atmosphere of the book.
For three generations, they were drawn from water, made fatherless or orphaned altogether, though there was no augury, blind prophet, or star that told of their fates. Each was raised to be disciplined and just. If there were books, they were well read. They passed down their own history by word of mouth. They were not inclined to speak of spiritual matters, but they believed that God had blessed them, for much had been made of what had been put into their hands, and not one would have said that it was his hands alone that had made it. What they shared were the wars of emperors, presidents, revolutionaries, fights to which men have always gone to fight, for an ideal, for a homeland, for a people. These were the truths that bound the family to each other and the land to which they returned when the fighting was done, but for one.
Hmm. That's beautiful.
Thank you.
So is there something that you're saying then about the connection, the legacy of war in families?
Yes, and I say that from never having been in the military, never having served in a war, but remembering deeply that time in the early 70s. I was born in 63, so in 1972 I was 9. And already thinking about that legacy within my own family. So both of my grandfathers fought in World War I. My father was in World War II. And my brothers were about to get drafted to Vietnam. They didn't. But in 1972, it was right there. And you couldn't miss, you know, watching the news with your father. The footage, the war was ever present. And I just remember thinking, so this is what I will do. I'll grow up and be drafted or somehow enter the military and fight in a war. So that early on, that's what had been passed on to me through the men in my family.
Also, I want to talk about nature and sort of the landscape of the book. It's the fictional town of Darden, Pennsylvania. But you grew up, as you say, in the area of Pennsylvania. What did you want to capture about that part of the country?
It's a particularly hard place, I think, anyone who lives there. Beautiful in its difficulty, the mountains, the weather is, you know, I would argue far more changeable than ever any Scottish countryside. We were outside all the time, building forts in the snow. It was never a time when we were not outside. And my mother would even say, if we were in a house and did the classic, well, we're bored, what should we do? My mother's refrain was, go outside. So nature was something I had to write about if I was writing about this part of the world. And I believe, too, that there, in many ways, we exist in nature almost as though nature itself were a kind of character, and I wanted to try to portray that.
I want to talk about religion in the book. The backdrop to that is you were in a Jesuit order for 8 years before you became a writer. How do you think religion shaped your writing and shapes your writing?
I think it certainly shapes it a great deal. I was writing even as a Jesuit. I was writing before that in college. Being raised as a Catholic, as a young boy in northeastern Pennsylvania in an Eastern European family with all of the ritual the Mass, the liturgy, the faith community being central. And so I would say that as a writer, I could not escape that kind of religious imagination, that belief that in the world there is a God and there is something larger than we are, and redemption is possible. That's I think what I carry with me from those times today.
And in the book, the main character Beau seems mm-hmm. to question religion,
sure,
if
yeah,
you will. Right?
Yeah.
He's skeptical. He has questions. Particularly, I'm thinking of the scene where he baptizes Ruth's baby mm-hmm. And surprises the priest that
right.
he's able to do that. Why make him a skeptic? Do you think? I mean, can you generalize and say that it's easier for people to relate to characters who have those types of questions, or you know, were you trying to say something there?
Yeah, I wasn't thinking about relating to characters. I was thinking more about my own personal held belief that the unbeliever and the deep believer are closer than anybody realizes. And in my own, you know, faith journey, there are those moments where unbelief is more of a powerful thing to grasp, or just to say, I just can't believe anymore. That's part of a powerful and deep faith journey. So Beau is a character who is skeptical, and also at the time of his life, you know, he's a young man who's running a business and he's working with his hands. And for him, there isn't the time to engage in the in the things of faith and religion that his mother does, for instance.
What do you hope readers take from the book?
I hope that they would look out at nature again and think about that tree or that flower, the tiny things that are at eye level, or maybe if you stoop down a bit, even in the city. I really wanted to create a place where we look again at what surrounds us. I would hope people would see that there's always this possibility of redemption in any situation, even when it's painful or uncertain as to how that might shake out, that we would somehow do all we can and then let the larger fact of it, you know, come to us as it will.
Hmm. You say you've always been interested in writing since you were very
young.
Yeah,
I have, yes. Yeah.
So what's the best advice you've ever been given about writing?
Wow, that's a good one. I have come to see this myself, is that writing is about showing up. The actual act of writing, you have to sit in a chair and you have to want to be alone in a room with words. And even if for a day, for 2 days, or for a week, you don't write a single word, go back to that desk, go back to that chair and show up. And eventually, if you're going to write, it will happen. So that's key. A writer shows up.
That's Andrew Krivak. He's the author of The Signal Flame and The Sojourn. He spoke with WBUR's Deborah Becker. Stay with us. Coming up, how a 4-year-old girl from Boston became the first legal challenge to school desegregation. I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tanya Mosley. Whenever school segregation comes up here in Boston, the first thing we often think about is busing from the 1970s. But Boston's history goes back much farther than that, all the way back to 1848. That's 100 years before Brown versus Board of Education. That's when the state of Massachusetts saw the case of Sarah C. Roberts versus the city of Boston. Sarah Roberts was just 4 years old when she tried to go to an all-white school. Her case was the first legal challenge to school segregation. Boston eventually became the first major city to desegregate its schools. This hidden history is now being told in a new children's book called The First Step: How One Girl Put Segregation on Trial. And the author, Susan Goodman, joins me now in the studio. Hello, Susan.
Hi, how are you?
So tell us a little bit how you found out about Sarah Roberts and her family, and what was your first reaction to the story?
Well, I moved to Boston in 1975, and I've lived here long enough that there are a million visitors who have come. And after many times on the Freedom Trail, mm-hmm. I said to myself, I can't do that anymore. So the next time I looked around and I found out that there was the Black Heritage History Trail. And when I was walking on this walking tour, which is the back of Beacon Hill, this is the first time I heard the story of Sarah C. Roberts v. Boston, and I was totally amazed. Mm-hmm. I had never heard of it. I'm a kids' book author. I've been a reporter. I know one has itchings for stories, and I was shocked.
You were shocked that you didn't know about this story.
Yes, and what I've found is actually nobody knows it. Well, not nobody, but very few people, surprisingly few people know this story.
What was happening in Boston during that time? We're talking 1848.
Right.
Give us a picture of that time in history.
Well, there's a reason why I think that they did the tour for the back of Beacon Hill, because it was an unbelievably active time in terms of abolitionists, black and white. People were trying to desegregate railroads. They were trying to get rid of integrated marriage. They were trying to get rid of what had become a lousy school. Sorry, mm-hmm. The Smith School became a bad school that was the school designated for African-American kids, and they had a boycott going on.
Speaking of that, the first steps, this book has a lot of details about the scenery of where Sarah grew up. For instance, I'd like for you to read an excerpt from the book after the point when Sarah was taken out of an all-white school with lots of books and things to play with to that segregated school you're talking about for blacks far away from where she lived. If you can read that for me.
My pleasure. Sarah would have to go all that way for a school that never taught subjects like history or drawing. All that way for Boston's only school without a play yard, a school that only owned one book. Every day, Sarah would walk past one, two, three, four, five schools she could not enter. And that was to get to the Smith School.
Talk about the importance of illustrating those vivid details for the reader, for young people specifically.
Well, I think it's important for many reasons. One, young people don't have, little kids don't have context. I mean, if I talk to you about something, how amazing that it was that this was before the Civil War, you know what a Civil War is. Mm-hmm. They don't. Also, we know almost nothing about Sarah. We know a lot about her parents, or particularly her father, but we don't. The only things that we know about her are what were reported in the census every 10 years.
And talk about that. What did you find out about her?
Nothing. Very, very little. I know that she lived with her family on Andover Street during the time of the case. 10 years later, we were out of her story because she was already old enough, and then they had moved to Cambridge. But about every 10 years, we check in and see who she was living. The census only tells you how old someone is,
yep.
where they live, mm-hmm. and who they were living with at the time.
You talk a little bit about her father, and in the book, one of the things that you point out specifically is that her father felt angry at the idea that she would have to attend an inferior school like he did. Mm-hmm. You said you know a little bit more about her mother and father. What can you tell us about them?
Well, I can tell you that her father in particular was an activist and came from an activist's family. There's a wonderful story about him growing up with his parents who had bought a pew in a church in Stoughton Corner, and the next time when they came to use the pew, it had been tarred. This was a white area,
right?
The week after, they brought their own chairs.
So that speaks to his activism. Exactly.
Totally.
Yeah.
The next week after that, it was ripped down. And they sat in the aisles for the rest of the year. So Benjamin Roberts was pretty determined. But as a children's book author, we really want a child hero. And so what I tried to do so that kids, and also as a nonfiction children's writer, I'm not allowed to put any kind of feelings in their heart, in a kid's heart that I don't know. I can't put any words in their mouths. So my strategy was to try to give so much detail about every scene that Sarah was in so the kids today could try to put themselves in Sarah's place and feel what I couldn't assign to her.
And what age is this book for, would you say?
Well, I think it really depends on who's reading it to the kid, or whether they're reading it to themselves. I know people who read this to second graders very effectively, even though there's some complicated things to it. I have as well. It's great for fourth and fifth graders.
Yeah. One of the things in your book that you point out is that this was taken all the way to the Superior Court by the country's first interracial legal team, which was Robert Morris and Charles Sumner. How did that happen? How did they get involved with each other?
Well, Benjamin Roberts knew he was going to go to Robert Morris. Robert Morris was an activist, an African-American activist, the second black lawyer in the United States, the first one to ever do a jury trial. And he was a real daring-do kind of guy. Mm-hmm. Eventually, when they go to Superior Court, he asks Sumner to join him. Sumner grew up on the back of Beacon Hill as well. Mm-hmm. His dad was a rabid abolitionist, so was Sumner. Sumner was called by Lincoln the conscience of our nation, and really, he was the one in this case. This is the first time when he really put words to some of the most important phrases that we use today. Like separate is never equal. Mm-hmm. That he was the first to really argue that in a court. And also equality before the law.
A powerful part of your book talks about the significance of Sarah's story, even though ultimately, they lost the right for her to attend that white school. And it sets in motion a movement towards integration. There's a passage that says, "The march towards justice is a long, twisting journey. Three steps forward, one step back, one step forward, three steps back. Laws change, and the march moves forward." Talk a little bit about why it's important for children to take away this message specifically. I'm thinking about all of the things that's happening right now in our world. Mm-hmm. And really just this idea that even if you lost, that doesn't mean that you're lost, it's lost forever.
You know, it's interesting. When I first thought about doing this, I spoke to a friend and she said, "You can't write a book about a case that loses for kids." Mm. I disagreed, and I wrote the book. And so now when I do school visits and talk to kids about it, I ask them. I say, "What do you think? Am I allowed to do this? Can I write this book for you?" Or what I always say is, maybe the grade before you, the little kids.
Right.
And kids to a one say, "No, of course you can do this."
Really?
And their reasons are profound. I mean, sometimes it's just we need to know history, but it could also be, how else will we learn that we have to keep trying? It's pretty inspiring.
You end this book with a passage from the 1954 Brown versus Board ruling, and this line is so powerful to me. "Separating children because of their race generates a feeling of inferiority that may affect their hearts and minds in a way unlikely to ever be undone." While there might not be a law on paper today that separates children by race, we're still seeing so much of this today. Did you find in writing this story for children that there were so many things that resonate for you today?
Everything. I mean, what can I say? I mean, I think I wrote at the end of this book, there's some back matter in it, you know, with a timeline, a segregation timeline. And it's so inspiring to be able to do that 100-year span between Sarah and Board of Ed. Brown versus Board of Ed. But then I couldn't stop there. I had to show what happened after that, and what you see is increasing segregation. And then, of course, there's the political situation today. I think that one of the most important things I learned when I wrote this book is if you have causes that are dear to you, you got to watch them like a hawk, and you have to work with other people because things change. They go forward and back.
Sarah Goodman, thank you so much for joining us. Sarah is the author of Susan. Well, I'm thinking about Sarah.
She's on my mind now.
She's on my mind and in my heart now, really. Susan is the author of more than 30 nonfiction books for children, including The First Step, How One Girl Put Segregation on Trial. Susan Goodman, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tanya.
Well, that's it for today and this week. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tanya Mosley. Have a great weekend. This is Radio Boston.